We continue tonight to try to set the stage for the things that we're going to be discussing in the book of Daniel. We want to go back just a little bit and pick up again on our history lesson. Nabopolassar, who was the king of Babylon, beginning about 626 B.C., began his rise to power as somewhat of a, I'll call him a small potato. But after the death of the king of Assyria, which had ruled over the kingdom of Chaldea, and I want to see if I can get our maps back up here just a little bit. You'll notice the rise of the Assyrian Empire here encompasses the what was to become the Babylonian Empire. And you see on this map, I think, perhaps better than the previous one, here is Babylon. And the Assyrian Empire has overtaken this area as well as most of the area that you see on the screen. But Nabopolassar's son, Nebuchadnezzar, and of course these names are difficult, was made commander of the army, and he marched against the city of Nineveh. And this was about 200, as you can see, 250 or so miles north of Babylon, and defeated the Assyrian army. The Assyrians then were in retreat. They retreated not only to Nineveh, but they started a bit north and west to Haran. And in our study last time, we talked a little bit about Pharaoh Necho. Remember us mentioning him in our last study, and we talked about King Josiah and how that King Josiah was not to go and to intercede with the armies of Egypt, but he did, and he was killed. This map depicts that. Pharaoh Necho and his army were coming up from Egypt, and they got to the place called Megiddo. Now that name ought to ring a bell in your minds, as many important battles were fought in the Valley of Esdraelon, where Megiddo was located. And Josiah was killed here. The Egyptians continued north to Carchemish. And it was at Carchemish in about 605 B.C. where the army of Nebuchadnezzar finally butted heads with the army of Egypt. And it was at this point then that the kingdom of Babylon was on the rise to establish itself as a world empire. Babylon then drove the Egyptian army back almost all the way to Egypt as they retreated. And then Babylon became the dominant power. And of course the purpose of our maps last time was to show the little place of Judah still on the map during the Assyrian rise, but then to show that Judah is gone here. But this map shows for us how that Babylon became such a dominating world empire when Nebuchadnezzar's army defeated the army of Pharaoh Necho and drove them on back to Egypt. Now, according to four cuneiform tablets that were discovered in the British Museum about 1956, the Egyptians received this crushing defeat at Carchemish, and that's how we come to arrive at the date 605. Now that's been troublesome to me for the last few weeks while I've been studying this to try to find out where that date came from. And that's where the date does come from one of these, or from four of these tablets that were discovered in the British Museum in 1956. Now, one result of this victory at Carchemish was that the Babylonians seem to have demanded hostages from Judah as evidence of good faith toward Babylon. And it was in this effort that Daniel and the names that we recognize perhaps the most, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were taken captives as we read in Daniel chapter 1, as youths. Some believe that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as defined by that word, along with Daniel, were somewhere in their years between about 12 and 18 years old. So they were young men. Some have kind of averaged that out and said, well, for argument's sake, we'll just call them 15-year-old boys. And anywhere in there, they were young boys. And to take the stand that they took is quite fascinating to me. I want you to notice that these young men, as they are described in Daniel chapter 1, let's open our Bibles, if you would, please, to that. We'll look at just a point or two. In verse 4, they are described as youths in whom was no blemish, but well favored and skillful in all wisdom, and endued with knowledge and understanding, science, and such as had ability to stand in the king's palace. These young boys, they were young men that were quite well educated. They were quite fit as far as their physique was concerned. They were without blemish. They were well-formed young men. And in lieu of those things, they were fit to represent the king and serve in the king's palace. We also might want to note that it was during this time, according to verse 2 of Daniel chapter 1, that the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, that is, into the hand of King Nebuchadnezzar. One of the things that we're going to emphasize throughout the book of Daniel is that God rules in the kingdoms of men. That becomes the theme of the book. And we're going to see that emphatically, but we also see that even as the book begins. With the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar, as we see on the outline of this map, we see clearly that it was God who gave authority into the hand of King Nebuchadnezzar in order that he might have the position of power that he had. Now, before I get too far ahead, I want to pass through some of these things, and I think that I have on here, if I can find it, an outline. Terry, my outline. I thought I had it on that, but I don't. I thought I had it already up. I guess I do have it already up. There it is. The book somewhat naturally divides itself into two parts. One is not as hard as the other. The second part of the book gets a little bit more difficult. In the first chapter, we want to notice of Daniel and these young men and their determination to remain pure. There are a lot of lessons that we want to try to drive home as we talk about these young men to these young people that are in the audience tonight and in this class. Second chapter, we read of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the image that he saw, and how disturbed he was about what he saw, and then Daniel's explanation or interpretation of the dream. And then in the third chapter, we're going to be talking about Daniel's three young friends that are identified there as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we're going to talk about how that King Nebuchadnezzar set up a golden image and demanded at the sound of the various musical instruments that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego bow down before the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then in the fourth chapter, we're going to talk about how difficult it was for Nebuchadnezzar to learn that God rules in the kingdoms of men. And how in the fifth chapter, his son Belshazzar also had to learn how that it is God who rules in the kingdoms of men. And then in the sixth chapter, we'll be talking about Darius, who is the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. One of the things that we'll notice as we study from the sixth chapter is that Daniel's period of captivity spans the change of power, the rule that existed in the land from the Chaldean influence on into the Medo-Persian domination. And it's during that time that Daniel is cast into the den of lions. Now, the second part of the book, beginning in chapter 7 to the conclusion of the book, deals with some more difficult things. And one of the things that we're going to try to do when we get to this portion of the text is to not only try to face the challenges of some of the things that are involved in this portion of the study, but to try to keep the book in its context and try to keep the book consistent with everything else that we can read in the Bible and in history on the subject that we'll be discussing, and try to examine some of the more difficult things in these few chapters. In the seventh chapter, we read of Daniel's dream of the four beasts and some of the things that we're going to be seeing in chapter 7 through chapter 12 in these visions. We'll be reading some language that is very similar to language that we will eventually, after we get through Daniel and Ezekiel, hopefully to get to the book of Revelation and talk about some of the language that is used there. In chapter 8, we'll be talking about Daniel's dream of the ram and the goat. In chapter 9, we'll be talking about Daniel's prayer and the vision of the 70 weeks, which gets interesting. And then in chapters 10 through chapter 12, we'll be talking about what I have generalized as Daniel's vision of the time of the end. Now, one of the things that we want to notice about that is that there are those who are premillennial teachers, and we're talking about that, I know, in our study on Sunday night. But there are those who are premillennial teachers who want to take some things that Daniel says and apply them to the second coming of Christ. One of the things that we want to observe is that there are a number of terms that are used in Scripture, both Old and New Testament, that talk about the time of the end that may not necessitate application to the second coming of Christ. And so some of these premillennial views we want to dispel and want to try to make some kind of proper application of those prophecies of Daniel in these more difficult chapters. Now, frankly, that's all I want to say about that until we get to that and talk some more about the first chapter as we introduce some of the things that Daniel has to say. So I want you to now, if you would, please open your Bibles to Daniel chapter 1. I know one of the things that is important to me, as most of you have been in classes that I have taught contextual studies, is to get a background for the things that we're going to study and to spend a little bit of time introducing the material. I think that's important. But eventually we get to the contextual study, and to me that's where the exciting part begins to arise. Let's notice, if you would please, in Daniel chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. Daniel chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. It says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem to besiege it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God. And he carried them into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God." Now let's pause there. What we're reading is what King Nebuchadnezzar did when he came through Judah and took captives. I want to notice with you, if you would please, at verse 2, that God gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. God gave into his hand. Now the theme of the book is a simple theme. God rules in the kingdoms of men. He did so even then when he gave Nebuchadnezzar the land of Judah. You remember the charts where we saw that God did not give Judah into the hand of Shalmaneser, the king of the Assyrians, but he did give the kingdom of Judah into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Now why? Darius? Okay.
That story about Jehoiakim cutting up, how many were it, 4 scrolls or something?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then burning them up in a pot.
That's right.
And then and those were the scrolls that Jeremiah had dictated to a scribe.
That's right.
God said that done this, I'm going to now just punish you and your descendants, and you will have no one that sits on the throne of David.
All right, that's right.
And that your body would be exposed to the heat of the day and the frost of the night.
Okay.
And it's almost like when you read that account, it's almost like Jehoiakim and his followers, they didn't have any fear. They didn't, it's almost like they didn't believe this.
Arrogant.
But this all came to pass.
It did. And that is really the answer that I was looking for. When we think of Hezekiah, as he ruled over the kingdom of Judah, they were faithful to the Lord. But now under Jehoiakim's reign, you've got a whole different attitude. Even as you go back to Josiah, who preceded Jehoiakim, if I recall the order correctly, I think he was a direct in the lineage. Josiah was a good king. Jehoiakim was a very rebellious king. And so it was inevitable, according to the very things that we have already tried to introduce, all the way back from the prophecies of Moses. When you're faithful in serving God, He'll bless you. When you're not, He'll curse you. And because of this arrogancy of Jehoiakim, we see that God allowed them to be overthrown. And that's right. That's why it wasn't done previously, and that's why it was done at that particular point in time. So yes, that is the answer to the question. God gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. It was because of the rebellion of Jehoiakim.
King Nebuchadnezzar, did he send Nehemiah request that he go back to Jerusalem and build the wall?
Different king. That was somewhat later. That was under the reign of King Artaxerxes, the king of the Medo-Persian Empire. That's after the time of Nebuchadnezzar. You've got the right idea, you just got the wrong time frame. Nebuchadnezzar ruled over the Babylonian Empire, which fell and was given to Cyrus, the king of the Medo-Persians, who then, a later king, was Artaxerxes. Nebuchadnezzar, in those instances, happened before Nehemiah. Okay? All right. Any other questions or comments? All right, let's look again at the first chapter of Daniel. It says, "The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, and he carried them to the land of Shinar, that is, into the heart of the Chaldean area, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Aspenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should bring in certain of the children of Israel, even of the seed royal, and of the nobles, youths in whom was no blemish, but well favored and skillful in all wisdom, and endued with knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability to stand in the king's palace, and that he should teach them the learning and the language or the tongue of the Chaldeans." Let's pause there for just a moment. In the reading. And what we want to notice about these young men, not only were they very knowledgeable in the learning of the Hebrews, but they're simply very knowledgeable. They're picked because of their skill to learn. And their learning is going to extend extensively into that of the not only the language, but the sciences and so forth of the Chaldeans. And I find that impressive about these three young men when you consider the age that they were. You might even refer to them as the cream of the crop among the captives. Now, one of the things that I want to ask you is when we read about these three young men, and later in this chapter when we read about their boldness to commit themselves, and even into the third chapter, to commit themselves to service unto the Lord, even in the spite of danger, why or how come, against the backdrop of Jehoiakim's reign, do we find such righteous young men that have now been brought into captivity? How do we explain, against the backdrop of Jehoiakim's wickedness, such good young men brought into captivity? Somebody taught them. That's right. Somebody taught them. Now, let's trace back just a little bit. These young men had lived perhaps about 3 years under the wicked reign of Jehoiakim. But who was king before that? Josiah was king before that. And what did Josiah do for the people of Judah?
He tore down the idols and reestablished God's
law. All right. So these young men had been brought up for some time before the reign of wicked Jehoiakim under the righteous reign of Josiah. And somebody taught them. They had learned some things that were right that caused them to have the conviction of heart that they had. Not only Daniel in the 6th chapter, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the 3rd chapter, and all four of them here in this 1st chapter when they purposed in their heart that they will not defile themselves with the king's dainties. I'm getting ahead of myself. But these young men were selected because of their wisdom, their knowledge, and their ability to learn. Yes, Joey? Right.
That he was singled out as being, he's famous. He's remembered for his zeal towards restoring worship to God by tearing down these idolatrous places.
That's right.
So a lot of people, quite possibly, learned a lot from Josiah just by example.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Josiah and Uzziah, at least for a time in Uzziah's life, shared some very commendable qualities.
I was going to say that contrast of this, when you get to this last thing, what's the name of the last king?
Jehoiakim.
Jehoiakim. It's interesting that it almost probably halfway through the book of Jeremiah, as God is giving the judgment upon Judah, upon what's left of his people, they've been so bad under his reign, and the king has been so bad, that God essentially says, no matter how much you whine and no matter how much you do, you're going away into captivity no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the first half of the book of Jeremiah is just a condemnation of the nation of Judah, just right down the line.
And you can't help, I can't at least, but wonder why, when they had seen this already evolve in Israel to the north, with the Assyrian captivity, and seen the stand of Hezekiah and the Assyrians all around them. But yet here's Judah still existing because they're faithful to God. And then to make the same mistake that Israel to the north had made only about, 130 or some odd years later, to do the same thing. I don't understand that, but that's what they did. And we need to take note of that just because we see someone else commit terrible things, that's no guarantee that we won't. And when we make the stand, well, I will never do that. We need to be careful and take heed lest we do. I mentioned a moment ago something that I want to revisit. I forgot something that I wanted to say about that. When in verse 2 it tells us that the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. It's impressive for us to notice the working of God in giving kingdoms to whom He will. We see that, of course, in the 4th chapter and are going to amplify that a little bit. But if you'll turn over to the 2nd chapter when Daniel is interpreting the dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had, you'll notice beginning at verse 36, it says, "This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king," verse 37, "art king of kings." This is Daniel 2. "Thou, O king, art king of kings, unto whom the God of heaven hath given the kingdom, the power, and the strength, and the glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heaven, hath he given into thy hand, and hath made thee to rule over them all. Thou art the head of gold." Now, often when we read that passage, we're trying to depict the image that King Nebuchadnezzar saw, while at the same time we want to notice that it's God who rules in the kingdoms of men. Everything that King Nebuchadnezzar had been given to him or given into his hand by God. Now that ought to cause us to recall something that occurred back much, much earlier during the lifetime of David in 2 Samuel chapter 11. You remember that David committed a very grievous sin. Who wants to tell me the story of what David did? That would be with Bathsheba. 2 Samuel chapter 11.
So he saw Bathsheba taking a bath on a roof and decided that he would call for her, and she went to him, and they had sexual relations. She became pregnant, and then he sent off and had her husband murdered.
All right, Uriah the Hittite. And of course, in the 12th chapter of 2 Samuel, we read where Nathan the prophet draws a picture for David to see of a man who had one little ewe lamb, raised it like a daughter, and another man who was a very rich man, had a guest come, and instead of slaying one of his lambs to feed his guest, he went over to his neighbor's and got that one little ewe lamb and killed it and fed it to his guest. And of course, David was angry and said that a man that would do that ought to restore it fourfold, and that he was worthy of death. And Nathan said, "Thou art the man." And it's there that I want to pick up in 2 Samuel chapter 12, reading beginning at verse 8. It says there, "I gave thee thy master's house and thy master's wives into thy bosom, and gave thee the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added unto thee such and such things." I'm simply trying to underscore in your thinking that we're not just talking about during the days of Nebuchadnezzar. We're talking about historically God rules in the kingdoms of men. Now, a question that I want to ask you is, does God rule in the kingdoms of men today?
Yes, he does.
All right, how do we know that? Romans 13, we find that civil order is ordained of God. God ordained civil order. Another passage that I want you to think about is, and I want you to check that, if it's 1 Timothy or 2 Timothy, chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, we see that we are to pray for those who are in positions of power and authority, those who are kings, those who rule over men. 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 through 4. Why are we to pray for those who are in positions of power if God can't do anything about it? Sometimes there are those who take the position that as far as civil power is concerned, that God just authorized civil power and it just goes in whatever direction that it goes, kind of like spinning a top and then it runs down, that God has no involvement in it. If that be so, then we have no real reason to pray for those who are in positions of power because God is helpless to do anything about it. And I deny that. If we can study the book of Daniel and come away with a greater impression that God rules in the kingdoms of men, then we'll see the importance of praying for those who are in positions of civil power. Now, God gave into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar Jehoiakim, the kingdom of Judah. Now, dropping down to talk a little bit more about these youths, I want you to remember the name of the master of the eunuchs, Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs. He has a very serious responsibility, and one, no doubt, that he takes very seriously. He has the responsibility of preparing these three young men, or these four young men, for what? What's going to be their task? Serve the king. Serve in the house of the king. Terry? All right. All right.
They're going to be given Chaldean names.
Yes. And so it becomes very important that their qualities exceed the norm. And so these are very special young men. I want you to also notice that these are not the only young men that are being considered for this role. Evidently, when the Babylonian king had conquered other nations or other peoples, he had taken captives from them too. Young men that were likewise to be prepared, and they were to be prepared by the Chaldean methods of preparing young men. We'll talk about that in just a moment in terms not quite so vague. By way of contrasting Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and Daniel with these others. Reading on just a little further in the text, these young men were to learn the language of the Chaldeans. It says, and the king, verse 5, appointed for them a daily portion of the king's dainties and of the wine which he drank, and that they should be nourished 3 years, that at the end thereof they should stand before the king. These young people who were taken captives from another place were to be conditioned, and I don't know of a better word to use to describe what was to be done to them. They were to be conditioned for the roles that they were to fulfill. It was going to take a period of time in order for that to be accomplished. 3 years they would be in training for the roles that they were to assume in the king's house. So special provisions were given by the king. They were to partake of his food. They were to partake of his drink to make them and develop them into what Nebuchadnezzar wanted them to be. You mentioned, Terry, that they had their names changed by the king. Interestingly enough, their names in Hebrew, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, had meanings. And the meaning of Daniel's name, I think we mentioned this last time, is God is my judge. The name Hananiah means the Lord is gracious. And the name Mishael, who is what God is. And then the name Azariah, the Lord helps. Now these names were changed to be something essentially diametrically opposed to what their original names had meant, in honor rather of the Babylonian gods. For example, Daniel's name was changed to Belteshazzar. Richard and I were talking before services what that name meant. And the name means a servant of Bel, B-E-L. And Richard was looking up some information for me a little while ago and found that Bel represents the Babylonian and the Assyrian form of Baal. Now that rings a name, true to you, does it not? Baal, the idol god that numerous times the children of Israel worshipped. But here we find that Daniel's name is now changed to a name that means he's a servant essentially of Baal. And then Hananiah, the Lord is gracious. His name was changed to Shadrach. That name implied some form of worship of the sun god. And then Mishael, his name was changed to Meshach. Mishael, which meant who is what God is, now means who is what the moon god is. So you see the significance of changing their names. And then Azariah, the Lord helps, changed to Abednego, that is, a servant of Nebo, again an idol god that existed in Babylon. Now, the thing that I find interesting, to say the least, is that Daniel never refers to himself by the term Belteshazzar, just identifies that that's what his name was changed to. Another thing that I find interesting is that when Daniel writes about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, when he speaks of them directly, he refers to them by their Hebrew names. When he speaks to them as names that were given or as they were identified or spoken to or about by the Babylonians, then he uses the Babylonian name. And the point I'm trying to emphasize is that Daniel, in his efforts to speak of the Hebrews, speaks of them by their Hebrew names, to give the honor and the praise unto God rather than unto the Babylonian gods that their names implied. Having said that, how would you like to be one of these young men? Wouldn't be an easy life, would it? If you'll notice in the text, now beginning at verse 6, it says, "Now among these were of the children of Judah Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and the prince of the eunuchs gave names unto them. Unto Daniel he gave the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart." I want to pause with that. The expression, "he purposed in his heart," what does that mean to us? He made a commitment. He had made a commitment. He had his intent determined, his conviction directed to serve God. He purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's dainties, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now why do you suppose that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not defile themselves with the king's dainties? Randy? I can tell. No. Okay, that works.
Choice food to king was probably something that was forbidden for the Jews to eat.
Okay. It could have been among the things that were defiled, that the Jews were not allowed to eat, and we see that outlined in Leviticus 11. Unclean animals, yes. It could have been that it was food that was used in worship of an idol that gave these young men problems. And of course, we see that dealt with in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. So there may have been a number of reasons why these young men would not contaminate themselves or defile themselves with the choice foods of the king, the wine of the king.
And the wine was probably fermented.
Probably. Likely that it was. It may have been watered down, but nonetheless, these young men refused these things. And if you'll notice further in the text, it says in verse 8, it says, therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now let's keep in mind what role Daniel and these other young men are in. They're not in the position of making demands. They're servants. They are young captives. They're in the position of making a polite, honorable request. But they're not in the position of making a demand. And so something regarding lessons on manners might be taught just here. That these young men make a polite, honorable request. They do not make a demand of the prince of the eunuchs. Secondly, we want to notice beginning at verse 9, now God made Daniel to find kindness and compassion in the sight of the prince of the eunuchs. Again, we want to see the involvement of God in this whole picture. They make a request, and God can honor that request by making these young men appear favored before the king or before the prince of the eunuchs. Now there's another incident that I want to call your attention to where prayer became beneficial to gaining favor before one in a political or civil position of authority. Turn, if you will, in your Bibles to the Old Testament book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah. You'll notice in Nehemiah chapter 1. In Nehemiah chapter 1. When Nehemiah has made inquiry concerning some of those who have returned from the city of Jerusalem, what was the condition of the city? The report is in verse 3 that there is great affliction and reproach that still exists in the city. It says, the wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. And it came to pass, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned and fasted, or mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Now Nehemiah is praying because he's learned of the terrible plight that exists in the city of Jerusalem. You'll notice in verse 11, as a part of the prayer, it says, O Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant, and to the prayer of thy servants who delight to fear thy name. And prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. Now I was cupbearer to the king. Now, here's where we were studying earlier, Roy, and noted that Nehemiah is cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. But in his prayer, he prays very simply that God might grant him favor before that king. Now that becomes significant Because in the second chapter, when Nehemiah appears before King Artaxerxes to serve him, his countenance is sad. Do you see that? Chapter 2, about verse 2. His countenance was sad. And King Artaxerxes noticed this. And then he asked Nehemiah, "Why is thy countenance sad?" Now I want you to picture this and get the thought clearly in your mind. Suppose you had the position that Nehemiah has to go in before the king, and you're not your usual chipper self, and the king asks you, "What's wrong with you?" Would that be something you would take lightly? Would you see that as a criticism from a king? "What's wrong with you?" And Nehemiah responds to the king, and he said, "Why shouldn't I be sad?" And then he recounts the condition of the city of Jerusalem. And then the king, Artaxerxes, asked Nehemiah, "What can I do to help?" Now, Nehemiah once again prays, but what was his initial prayer? That he might find favor before the king. Now, even young captives, such as Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and even Daniel, can find favor before civil authorities. Question? Comment?
Well, you know, the lesson there that you're pointing to, I think, is really embodied in the 21st verse.
All right. Of Daniel 1. Yeah, well, we're not there quite yet, but that is true. The period of time in which Daniel served in this capacity indicates something.
Yeah, the word thus in the verse.
Yes, it's a conclusion. Well, that's right. He was there over. He bridged the gap between the Babylonian and the Medes and the Persians. He was there for a long time, which indicates he had not only a presence there, but he desired the place that he had. He could have gone home, but he desired to stay and in this role. And that speaks volumes. Roy, and then David. Why didn't they? Well, there are a couple of reasons. One might have been that eating of the king's choice food might have defiled them because the Jews had a particular diet that they were to eat. Certain foods were unclean. It may have been that the king's choice foods would have been some things that the Jews could not eat. It might have also been that some of the things that the king offered them to eat, a portion had been offered to the idol and worshiped to the idol. And so the Jew wouldn't want to eat that either.
So it's what they represented.
It's what they represented, yes. David and then John. Okay.
In Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 13 says, "The Lord said, in this way the people of Israel will eat the foul food among the nations where I drive them. Then I said, not so, sovereign Lord. I have never defiled myself from my youth until now. I have never eaten anything found dead or torn by a wild animal. Not unclean meat has ever entered my mouth." So it gives you some other things that the could have been practice of the Near East world that they would be driven to. There's other things other than just eating pig. I mean, there's a lot of
oh, yes.
Life. And then there's some of it might be meat that they could eat, but not because they found it dead or an animal come in and killed it. If they were out herding the sheep and a lion killed the sheep, they couldn't then eat it like they could when they got butchered and killed themselves.
That's right. Okay. So there were a variety of reasons, Roy, why they might not have been able to eat in good conscience the things that were presented to them.
Doesn't make a lot of sense to me that it would be anything other than a type, because then why would the command be term to sacrifice a hamburger to this one, and this one that's not, it's the same nutritional value, so he wouldn't see anything. Well, fine, I'll just get you one that wasn't sacrificed.
Why would the king, why would it bother the king?
The one who was set a little further down.
Oh, the prince of the eunuchs?
Yeah, he says, why should you look more haggard than the rest of your people that are your age? The only reason he would say that is if it were like truly different.
Yeah. Well, two, we want to keep in mind the role that this man is in. King says, you young people eat this. You enforce it. You see to it that they do. Now that might get his attention if he feeds them anything else. So hamburger versus pork chop over here might not make much difference to us as far as nutritional value is concerned, but if it was by the edict of the king, it might raise a flag in your mind.
Well, just hamburger pork chop's different, but hamburger.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Perhaps. Perhaps. David?
I was just thinking, too, different cultures have different foods that they even prepare. And, you know, the foods that Israelites might have been used to that were nutritional stuff might not even be available in some of the countries.
All right. That's a possibility. Let's drop on down just a few verses and see what it was that Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah will eat. Beginning at verse 10, it says, "And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse looking than the youths that are of your own age? So would you endanger my head with the king?" Now, the prince of the eunuchs at this point doesn't see this as equal nutritional value. He has a responsibility to make these young men look supreme. And if they're going to reject the food that's offered to them and select to eat something else that might, at least in his mind or at least in the mind of the king, seem to be inferior, then we've got a problem. So he's concerned about that. He said, my head's going to be in danger. And then Daniel said to the steward, whom the prince of the eunuchs had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Now, pulse is a word we don't use much anymore either. But just to boil it all down, they're saying, we'll eat vegetables. You bring for us vegetables, and instead of the king's wine, we'll just drink water. Now, young people, how would you like a diet like that? Vegetables and water. I'm not getting very good impressions back there. Well, the point being, Daniel figured that this was better nourishment and would help them to grow and be more fit than it would to eat of the king's choice foods. Now, the choice foods might taste better, but as far as the nutritional value and what would benefit them the most and make them the healthiest and so forth would be to eat vegetables and drink water. Now, I'm not going to pause here and try to drive that lesson home because too many of you have seen me eat, but we might be in better shape if we ate more vegetables and drank more water. All right.